All right, are you guys ready for this conversation? What a way to begin a podcast slash YouTube conversation. Today, I'm starting a series called The Diversity of Trans. I'm going to have six different guests on the show for this series. And one of my goals is to highlight the diversity of trans perspectives and experiences so that people who are not either trans or don't identify as trans or are not really part of this broader conversation can understand that there is a great deal of diversity within this conversation. This series also surrounds the launch of my book, Embodied, Transgender Identities, the Church, and What the Bible Has to Say, which comes out on February 1st. So I'm going to do a few shows before the launch, one show on the day of the launch, few shows after the launch of the book. So I encourage you to go check out my book Embodied, where books are sold. Basically, yeah, go to Amazon and you can check it out and order it. It's basically an overview of the trans conversation from a Christian perspective. There's a lot of science, a lot of theology, a lot of ethics, a lot of ontology in the book, and a ton of relationships that are woven throughout the book Embodied. So check it out if you're interested in engaging a Christian perspective on this conversation. On the show today, we're going to kick things off with Miranda Yardley. Miranda does not fit any of your categories. Miranda identifies as transsexual. That's her preferred term, not transgender. And she explains why a little bit in this episode. Miranda is incredibly sharp, incredibly provocative. In fact, Miranda introduced herself to me as the world's most hated transsexual. And I think when she says that, she means hated by those who would be on, I would assume, the far left. Miranda is a transsexual who is very critical of a trans activist ideology. And that's largely what this show is all about. Miranda's perspective is one perspective, and we're going to highlight various other perspectives that might differ from Miranda, as you'll see if you keep listening to the series. And Miranda's actually really excited about that. Miranda is an atheist who loves churches. She's a transsexual who's very critical of a transgender ideology. But anyway, without further ado, please welcome to the show the one and only Miranda Yardley. Started our conversation just from my audience. I typically talk offline with people for a little bit, then hit record. But Miranda, you were you started our offline conversation saying, "As an atheist, I obviously have a great love for old churches." And I'm like, "Whoa!" So, can you? How does that work? What do you mean, as an atheist, you have a great love for old churches? That's a very fascinating way to introduce yourself.
I think most atheists love a good church because they, I mean, you know, churches are very historic places. They are, you know, they are often built by the people who lived in an area and, you know, built with blood and sweat and tears. And with all of that comes a load of history. And as I was explaining, the place that I live is just outside a place called Southend-on-Sea. I live in a place called Lee-on-Sea, and it is in the Thames estuary. And the history of this area is, it's all intertwined with a need to defend London from either the Spanish or the French or the Germans or the Dutch or some other group of marauders. And there are histories of, you know, there are rich histories of piracy and smuggling, because of course there's, you know, it's on the English Channel, and often, you know, you've got the English Channel meeting the North Sea, and it's, you know, it's just that type of area that attracts, you know, ruthless pirates and smugglers. Yeah. And, you
so
know,
is it is it strictly because of the historical significance of old churches, or is there something mysteriously, I don't know what term to even use, spiritual transcendent, that is interesting for somebody particularly who would be an atheist, or if that makes sense?
I think one of the great things about old churches is, of course, that they're usually very quiet.
Yeah.
You know, you go into a church, it's very quiet, and I love peace and quiet. I love being in the quiet. I love, you know, I'm happy to sit at home reading a book in a tranquil environment and just, like, you know, just have quality time.
Yeah.
And just, you know, just enjoy. I love my own company. You know, I don't continually need people to affirm my existence or make sure that I'm okay or anything. I just like, you know, like my own company. I like interesting things. Churches are interesting things because they are, you know, often in this country we get a lot of churches with stained glass windows and ornate carvings. I was mentioning to you the church in Pegglesham, which is, you know, is medieval. It's got these amazing primitive carvings on the floor of skulls and crossbones, and you know, it's stuff like that really interesting, and you know, it's quite cool to do that. And this church is in a village called Pegglesham, which is very remote. There's probably 100 people that live there, and it's remote by English standards. It's probably 6 kilometers from the nearest settlement, you know, the nearest decent sized settlement. And, you know, to the north, you've got, various tributaries of other rivers and the North Sea. To the east, you've got the North Sea. To the south, there's not an awful lot, it's just quite, and, you know, it's remote, and it's actually quite nice being out there, because it's, this part of Essex is all very flat. You get all this big sky, and it's just a really nice way to spend an afternoon exploring somewhere like that, and just being at one with yourself.
Well, let's, for my audience, I mean, I would say most of my audience, I have largely a Christian audience. Maybe half, maybe probably more than half would say they're, of a kind of evangelical, which when I hear atheists describe what an evangelical is, I would say oftentimes it is more describing a fundamentalist evangelical. My audience is not going to resonate with the fundamentalist brand of evangelical. For the most part, they're not going to resonate with that. They would be more of a kind of just mainstream Christian audience. But I would say, I'll only say that because most of them might not know your name or your writing. So why don't you give us a bit of a biography of yourself and how you became interested in a, if I can say it, a very interesting voice in the broader trans conversation.
Well, I often describe myself as being the world's most hated transsexual. And I don't think that I think Debbie Hayton is making a good attempt to usurp that particular throne. But I don't think that, I don't think Debbie's quite there yet. Got a bit, a little bit further to go. I by my nature, I like to be, you know, I'm interested in things. I like to be, I like to think I've got a sense of self-awareness, and I got into this whole thing maybe, 7 years ago, maybe.
Okay.
Might be a bit longer, might be a bit less time ago. I'd read something online about how awful these women were, feminists, radical feminists, about how awful they were to trans people, and that the lives of trans people were being threatened, and were put, you know that we as a group of people were being ostracized and subjected to torrents of abuse and hate and all sorts of allegations of being attempts to keep us out of public life, and, you know, all these dreadful things these women were supposed to be doing. So what I did was I went on to Twitter and decided to look up some of the names of these women who were reputed to be, were reputed to be evil, awful individuals. And I checked out their Twitter accounts and saw that they were having conversations with people who were claiming to be trans, and they were saying, they were being a bit, taunting them by saying, "Have a good day, sir," and emphasizing the fundamental role of one's biology in dictating whether or not one is a man or a woman. And I looked at what the women were saying, and I thought, well, okay, I'm not seeing many death threats here or anything like that, but wow, being a bit mean to the poor trannies. And what I then, I drilled down into a few threads, and then I saw what it was that these trans people, who were not just kids, but who were adults who were known trans activists and known campaigners for what they considered to be the rights of trans people. I looked at what these invariably trans women were saying to women, and I could not believe that the utter misogyny and the hate and the utter intolerance and the lack of empathy that I saw with women. I found it absolutely repugnant that this group of people who were there, who were supposed to be on some level part of my own social group, mm-hmm. whose contempt, not just for women, but for themselves, was such that they would go on, that essentially they were and continue to spend their entire lives trolling women, baiting women. I would still see it today. It's the same culprits that I saw then, I see them there, I see them now, using the same tired old arguments, banging their same old drum of saying the same old thing, and demonstrating, in spite of their many years of having lived as a woman, their utter callous lack of empathy for women.
Wow. Can you unpack that a little? Like, where does that come from? And I assume when you're talking about the trans activists who were berating gender critical feminists, radical feminists, that these were
any woman really who disagrees with them. Really, I mean, that's the way I read it. There's this word that's been bandied around for years. This word TERF, which is supposed to be trans exclusion radical feminist, and it's glued to anybody as being anybody who disagrees with transgender ideology is called a radical feminist. I don't think there are many people who are being called TERFs who are actually radical feminists in the sense of people who deconstruct the way that the reproduction role of women is instrumentalized as a tool of oppression, and who campaign for women's support groups and women's centers and groups like that. I don't think that many of the people who are being branded as being TERFs are the sort of people doing the work that radical feminists have historically done. Like, for example, the women's groups behind things like the Vancouver Rape Relief Center or the anti-prostitution campaigning that Julie Bindel does, or the writing and the writing and activism and sheer insistence that women work hard on them, work hard on themselves and their ideas, that Andrea Dworkin did. It's not these type of women who are being called radical feminists, or not these type of people who are being called radical feminists. It's radical feminism is just being demonized. The idea that these are women who are feminists, are, these uppity women, is what is being used against women. Essentially, what they're saying is that women's groups that exist for women are a pejorative, and just tells you everything you need to know about the way that transgenderism and transgender activists see women and women's groups.
Yeah, yeah. I think some of my audience might be familiar with that, but others might not. You know, TERF, trans exclusionary radical feminist. It is a slur that people who are against what they're talking about have used of them. I think gender critical feminist is the phrase that they would use of themselves. Even radical feminism, they would say, we're not being radical, we're just being consistent, I think is what they would say. Gender critical feminist. And so within even for my audience, who majority might be evangelical, you know, we're very used to liberals and conservatives, you know, dividing across the line on all these issues or whatever. I tell them, you know, when it comes to the broader trans conversation, there are no liberals and conservatives. It's one big hot mess. And you have people who would be very much not politically or socially conservative, very much at odds with certain kinds of ideologies. But I want to back up a little bit because my audience might be scratching their head. So you are transsexual, and yet you're very critical of various forms of trans ideology. Can you unpack that? How is your experience, would you say, different than what is maybe being popularized in the broader culture? If I'm not even wording it correctly, please correct me.
That's okay. It's okay. I think there are probably three things that separate me from most of the trans activists out there that you see today. I think the first thing that separates me from them, this is going to sound terribly arrogant, is that I can think for myself. And I see what I see within trans activism, and I've written quite a few things on this, mainly because it gave me a chance to quote liberally from On Liberty by John Stuart Mill, one of my favorite thinkers. Yeah. I'm a massive fan of John Stuart Mill. I know that some of his ideas on democracy and government weren't particularly good, but as a thinker, I'm fascinated by his work, and I'm fascinated by the work of Harriet Taylor as well, who I've written about. The way I see what I found is that, or what I have found is that a lot of the claims made by trans activists don't respond very well to sunlight. What I mean is, if you look at some of the claims that they make, like, for example, what was the claim that 1 in 12 trans people die before they're 30 or kill before they're 30? If you look at the etiology of that claim, it was some sort of throwaway comment on a blog that it became a meme and entered the mainstream. There's absolutely no truth to it. If you look at the message behind Transgender Day of Remembrance, the idea is that trans people are killed at a far higher rate than anyone else. It doesn't stand up to daylight. You look at the trans women who are murdered in great numbers, and it is generally very patriarchal, very, very violent. I don't mean that patriarchy is synonymous with violence, or do I? but you look at the very patriarchal societies where you see a lot of trans people getting killed, or a lot of trans women getting killed. It'll be countries like Mexico and Brazil and Ecuador, and even Italy. There is quite a high comparative death rate there. And you look at the deaths in countries like Brazil and Mexico, both great examples, and the USA. Predominantly, they are black or Hispanic. And you see in the reports that are made that there'll be a group of seven shot, and you'll think, well, that looks like some sort of gangland killing. So you're thinking that's going to be drugs or prostitution, and it's difficult to underestimate. It's difficult to underestimate. I'm trying to say that.
Underestimate.
Or it's difficult.
Yeah.
No, it's difficult to overestimate how little in common the white middle-class computer programmers in North America who are standing there campaigning for their trans rights, or in the UK campaigning for their trans rights. It's difficult to overestimate how little these guys have in common with the poor black and Hispanic trans women out there who are actually being killed. And the way that these deaths have been co-opted primarily to benefit white middle-class males is actually properly repugnant.
Wow. So you're saying that there's something much more ethnic that needs to be considered when we're considering the murder rate of typically trans women, biological men transition to female. But there's something much more ethnic at work here than simply a conversation about trans persecution per se.
These countries, first of all, just to be clear, I don't think anyone can transition to female. You're either female or you're male. That's it.
Right. Okay.
That's it and forever it shall be. But if you look at the murders that exist within these countries, the culture in, for example, Mexico is, you know, Mexico, beautiful country, amazing culture, really macho culture, though.
Yeah.
And very, you know, homosexuality is not universally celebrated. And there is a massive problem there with gangs and drugs and prostitution. You look in America, in North America, there are indications that a lot of these trans women who were murdered in North America are murdered by people that they know, possibly boyfriends or partners. There are indications sometimes that, you know, that killed in a hotel room, it would suggest some form of survival prostitution. That, you know, a lot of these deaths are occurring with people who are poor, that there are, you know, if we're going to look at it as try and work out or what sort of axes these are lying on, it's going to be poverty, it's prostitution, it's drugs, it's organized crime. And the difficult lives these people are leading, their difficult lives and their often horrific and premature deaths are being used by a group of people who have absolutely nothing in common with them to further their own political goals.
Wow. Okay, so that's one area where you would differ from trans activist ideology. And again, that's kind of a broad brush statement, but we're dealing on you know, a broad level here. What are some other areas that you would say, as a transsexual person, how you would differ from kind of the dominant narrative that we see on social media, news outlets, and so on?
Oh, where else would I differ? I don't think you can change sex. I think that the idea that you can change sex is a fantasy. I think that it is indulged by a number of people, and quite honestly, I think it's indulged by some people who can't actually think for themselves, but they're thinking, well, you know, your sex is simply down to your genitalia. In fact, but it's not. Your life as a man or a woman is very much set.
Yeah.
From the moment you come into the world and that you begin to navigate the world as being a man or a woman, as is a quote from Simone de Beauvoir, which is very often misinterpreted, often willfully misinterpreted, that one does not, what one is made, one does not, one is not born a woman, one becomes a woman, is the foundation of that statement is that a woman becomes a woman through living in a world dominated by men, and it's through being a woman in a world dominated by men that this is that which makes the woman. She's not born like that. She is a product of living in a world that is dominated by men.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the quote. I have not read the original work, unfortunately, so that's interesting that that's the original context of that. I am curious, just from my audience too, because you use the term transsexual, not transgender. I know a lot of people would be very offended if they identify as transgender and are called a transsexual. For some people, that's more of an offensive term, but you kind of go out of your way to say transsexual, not transgender. Can you, and I've read enough of your stuff, I kind of know where you're going to go, but can you, and this deals with sex and gender and just gender as a ontological concept as a whole, why do you prefer transsexual, not transgender, as your own self-identity?
I think, you know, even the word transsexual, I have a I have issues with, in the I can see that people would imply that it means that one can actually transcend the the boundaries of sex, and that you move from one sex to another. I think in some ways the term can be read as if to say that, you know, one doesn't do that. One recognizes the reality of the sex, but one attempts to cross that boundary. But it is as hard a boundary as you can possibly get, and you can't you can't transverse it. I don't think that being trans is a I don't think it is a state that we see necessarily in other creatures. I have a friend of mine that I talk to quite a lot, and when we look at patterns of behavior and we're thinking about when we're analyzing patterns of behavior and thinking how these things play out in the real world, we think, well, how would this be replicated within the animal kingdom? How for example, would we know whether or not a cow was transgender? You see where I'm going? That's a slight little troll there. Because I have someone in mind when I'm saying that. He'll be very flattered. Where is this type of behavior replicated within the animal kingdom? And the answer is, it's not really, is it?
Right. Yeah.
No, it's not. It's I think that this is a peculiarly human type of behavior. One of the things that's put out there is, it's like, oh, look, we've got people, you know, the other societies have third genders. If you look at what these third genders were in societies that had these societal constructs, which were always hierarchical, by the way, you know, it's not like they were something that, you know, that suddenly these were very enlightened. They were a way of dealing in that society with homosexuality.
Yeah.
So the idea of these third genders being something that is progressive, that has suddenly been erased, is, you know, it's not. It's something that existing in a society is a way of dealing with homosexuality, in particular dealing with the need in a society to be able to accommodate people who were homosexual, and to, you know, to give them a way in which they could live their life without challenging the equilibrium of that particular society, if you see what I'm getting at. So really, it's not a particularly great idea to have, you know, what underlay these ideas of these third genders and whatever wasn't some sort of amazingly open-minded liberal attitude. It was that they just needed a box to put people in that were gay.
Well, for example, I mean, if for those who aren't maybe tracking, you know, in Samoan culture and in Polynesia, you know, you have the fa'afafini, which is a term given to basically feminine gay men. It's not a sexual, like biological sex kind of category. It's there's very little difference. And one of my best friends is Samoan. He grew up in Samoa, and the way he describes the fa'afafini, it's not like this is a kind of a male female fa'afafini. It's not like it's a ontologically on par category with male and female. It would be very similar to just a feminine gay man who kind of lives that out, you know. Ooh. In many ways that a more stereotypically feminine gay man would in our society. That category, at least in Samoa, doesn't have the kind of categorical weight that some Westerners want to invest into it and then bring it back into kind of speaking into our culture. I'm not a sociologist, but that's kind of, I think it has limited value, quite honestly. But
it sounds to me like, you know, what you're describing is essentially it's just doing what societies do with effeminate homosexual men, and that is to try and kick them out of the man box.
Yeah.
And I think therein lies a lot of the problems that you know, we see with transgender people, that a lot of the issues there arise from the from these men being kicked out of the man box, and it's down to women to deal with the fallout from it. You know, it's women's spaces they want, it's women's women's places on shortlists they want. It's women's sports that they want to infiltrate. It's, you know, the whole thing, it's like a... It's like an infiltration into women's culture that is being done without any form of respect for individual or group boundaries.
Interesting.
You know, you can say that these men identify as women, and that here they go infiltrating women's culture so that they are, you know, that they're identifying as women. But I think that, you know, these cultural structures that women may have that exist because this is what the life of a woman entails. These, you know, these men are not, they are infiltrating those as imposters, and they may be identifying as women, but they sure as hell aren't identifying with women. They are not paying any heed to the privacy or comfort or even showing the respect that women, you know, I think that males should show women. We should respect each other. And I just don't see any of that coming from what is being called the trans community or their allies.
You've talked a bit about, and this is kind of underlying the point you're making here. There's a subtype of trans experience, autogenophilia, that is, as far as the research shows, you know, strictly from an experience with biological males. And there's been, there's a whole spectrum of views on autogenophilia, all the way from it doesn't exist and you're a transphobe if you even say the word, all the way to most biological males who identify as trans would have an autogenophilic experience. Can you unpack, one, for my audience, what autogenophilia even is? And then, two, I think you would be, as I've read your, I don't have a stat, but I think when I've heard you talk, you seem to be more on the side of a lot of people who identify as trans women seem to match this kind of subtype of trans experience. Would that be an accurate way to, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but would that, can you unpack autogenophilia for us and give us your perspectives on that?
Sure. Be very happy to. Autogynephilia, I find it absolutely fascinating. The whole idea is it's become a area of, I don't know what to call it, sociology, whatever they call it, sociology, sexology, human behavior. It's human behavior, isn't it? Anthropology? I don't know. I've become absolutely fascinated by it, and if I could find the money, I'd love to do. I've got in mind a couple of ideas for some. I'd like to do some research work, some graduate research work. I'd love to do a PhD in something. I've got some great ideas that have sprung to me from the work that I've done. The whole idea of autogynephilia is, it's something that arises from attempts to categorize and explain the behavior of men who live as women. And I use the term live as women as, you know, with some mental italics or scare quotes or something on there. I don't think it's possible for a man to live as a woman without resorting to some form of cultural stereotype. Now, if we go back to about 1918, the German researcher Magnus Hirschfeld, he wrote a book called, whose title I think loosely translates as Transvestites, and he wrote about the observed behavior of men who enjoyed cross-dressing. And I can't remember if it was him. I think it was him. And he categorized cross-dressing behavior into around, what, maybe six categories. And what's quite interesting about this is that Hirschfeld was probably the first person to systematically examine, categorize, and attempt to come up with some sort of taxonomy around the human behavior of cross-dressing or I don't want to call it cross-sex behavior because it's kind of not. If it was cross-sex behavior, then, you know, I'm sure more trans people would be queuing up to do the washing and wipe up all the shit off the floor that always seems to be get left to the women. Am I allowed to swear on your podcast?
You are, yeah. You be you. You be you. Yeah.
It wasn't gratuitous. It was for emphasis. And so Hirschfeld came up with this idea, and he found that a lot of men who participated in some form of cross-dressing did it with, and there was some sort of sexual arousal involved. And you know, Hirschfeld's work is seminal. It is the it's the work that really starts this idea off. Although there is evidence that other cultures, I think it's referred to in the Hadith, for example, you know, the second book of Muhammad. Is that there is a reference there to there being two types of cross-sex behavior in males, one from feminine homosexuals and one from heterosexuals who were, you know, were rather less feminine. Another interesting thing about Hirschfeld is you'll often see a lot of transgender activists complaining about how awful it was that Hirschfeld's library of sexology was destroyed by the Nazis, the Hirschfeld Institute was destroyed, and all of this original work, the first person to ever research transgender women, his work was destroyed by the Nazis. If they actually read his work, they wouldn't be so happy about it, because of course, you know, Hirschfeld wrote about this trans behavior as essentially being transvestites and recognized that behind the behavior of a lot of men there was a sexual element involved with this cross-dressing and this and what we now see is this persona that that the trans person adopts, or the trans male adopts. Mm-hmm. And this type of behavior seems to be, you know, we can categorize it for males. And if we fast forward to the 60s and the 70s, a Canadian researcher by the name of Ray Blanchard was looking at the behavior of cross-dressers and transsexuals. And what he was attempting to do was to come across, what he needed was a word. He needed a word to differentiate between younger feminine gay men who were exclusively attracted to members of the opposite sex, who seemed to form one cohort of transsexuals, and a second group of men who were not feminine, who were unremarkably masculine, and were heterosexual. Mm-hmm. And what he found was that he could delineate the population of males who transition to women according to two types that was down an axis of their sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. So essentially you had a bunch of gay men becoming gay men's idea of what a woman is, and then you had a bunch of straight men becoming a straight man's idea about what a woman was. Mm-hmm. And what he'd found is that the delineation was on sexual orientation, that you had a straight cross-dresser or transvestite who became a transsexual. And then you had a homosexual transvestite or who became a transsexual. Mm-hmm. And that the two groups of people had generally, there was some overlap, mm-hmm. The two groups of people had different sexual histories. One was homosexual, almost exclusively homosexual, and one was heterosexual with a history of erotic cross-dressing. And what got Blanchard and his colleagues, J. Michael Bailey and mm-hmm. anyone else who has touched this this fascinating academic subject, which has become the internet debating dumpster fire, quite literally. it's made a lot of trans people unhappy is that what it does is it recognizes that behind the straight cross-dresser has a is more likely to have a history of self-arousing, eroticization when, you know, when presenting oneself as a woman in the only way that a man can ever present as a woman to themselves, which is a man being a man's idea of what it is to be a woman, if you get me.
Yeah.
So the whole idea behind this is that there is, in summary, we have a delineation between two types of male transsexual. By male transsexual, I mean men who claim to be women. You have the first type, who are homosexual, and they are feminine, and they become a very feminine type of transsexual. And then you have the heterosexual transsexual, or the non-homosexual transsexual, should I say, because that itself covers a whole bunch of different sexual orientations, which appear to have at some point demonstrated a form, you know, this self-arousal, this eroticization at some point within their history. Now, just as this idea is not very well understood, the way that this early interest, because it's usually is based upon an early interest in cross-dressing, the way that this turns into a adult transsexual is not very well understood. It's not like this person has a fetish and is walking around continually, you know, in a state of a hyper excited state of arousal all the time. The way that the autogynephile almost comes to terms with this the site of their personality is being compared by Anne Lawrence, who wrote an amazing essay called Becoming What We Love, which contextualized this idea of the autogynephilic transsexual becoming this, becoming this person, essentially becoming what they love, and contextualize it as being a romance that the man has with themselves, that they become the woman that they love.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Anne Lawrence. Her book, Men Trapped in Men's Bodies, which is very, yeah. I mean, unknown largely, except the people who are really deep into this conversation. But Anne Lawrence is a medical researcher, MD, PhD, and identifies as a transsexual who experiences autogynephilia. So there's no real argument you can make. But, I mean, that book, she surveyed tons of people who very much match Blanchard's description of this. I think I appreciate Anne Lawrence's work because she gives a lot of nuance to it. Cause I think some of the criticism, at least of Blanchard's earlier presentation of this, as I understand this, is it was too compartmentalized, too clean, too neat, you know, this category, that category. I don't know if that's even a fair representation of what he actually says, but what Anne Lawrence does is she shows a lot of nuance, the complexity, and I'm going to ask a question here in a second, but I got to get all this background story. But, you know, there's some people, you know, I'll mention it in a blog or writing. I'll always get people who say that's offensive. Like, I can't believe you even mentioned that. Like, that's controversial. How could you even? I'm like, first of all, the research is pretty sound. Like, I'm not saying all. I'm not saying most. I don't know the percentage of trans-identifying males who have this experience. I really don't know, but there's a decent amount. And whenever I do talk about it, I've got several friends that have come out to me and said, who aren't even in the LGBT category at all, but they say, oh my gosh, there's a name for that because I've wrestled with that, you know, lots of people. So I think this experience, first of all, does exist. second of all, I think it's unhelpful to pretend like it doesn't. So I guess my question to you is why is there such an allergic reaction to autogynephilia and such a resistance to it as a concept? Is it because it kind of can, there's a lot of shame maybe involved that overly fetishizes the experience? I mean, or why do some people want to deny that it exists?
I think there are several reasons. I think first of all, if we can recognize that the truth sets people free, we also have to recognize that, first of all, it makes them very, very angry. And I can see it being very difficult for people who have... So we have to remember that the trans community, to the trans community, having an open and honest discussion about autogynephilia is anathema. It is not something that you do unless you can run very, very quickly from the rocks that they're going to throw at you. Huh. Because it is something that is it's something that they have mandated out of the discussion within their groups, and it's something that they attempt to discredit very unsuccessfully. Bearing in mind that the internet and Twitter, in particular, is awash with extremely good examples of every single behavior that Blanchard's theory predicts for transsexuals. You look at what Blanchard's, the predictions that the theory makes, and like all great theories, it's testable. You can see the predictions that it makes about the behavior of the people that you see out there. I mean, you know, there was one I remember a few years ago. One of the quite well-known trans activists was waxing lyrical on Twitter about how he'd always been a lesbian, but now was fantasizing about men, but was talking about men as being these faceless, personalityless things. They were fantasizing about being with a man, but it wasn't a complete man. They were faceless. There was nothing to them. They were fantasizing of the idea of being with a man, but not of being with a man. You see where I'm going with that? Now, if you've read Men's Trapped in Men's Bodies, that is exactly what Anne Lawrence talks about. Absolutely, word for word. One of the fantasies is that, you know, that some of these men who are having these types of fantasies, these types of homosexual fantasies, they're having these fantasies, and the men that they're fantasizing about, they're faceless. They're not men. They are, oh, what's the word I would use for it? They are almost like, they're like dummies.
Yeah.
You look at, I mean, you know, I wrote a piece a few years ago on pornography and autogynephilia. I just looked at this was before I discovered the writing of Andrea Chu. How I never saw Andrea Chu's writing before researching this article is beyond me. Where I looked at the influence of pornography on trans people who transitioned. And you could see there that there was a fixation that they were developing through watching pornography, and they were literally becoming exactly what it was that they love. Mm. There is so much evidence out there. Now, on the most basic level, it said that the autogynephile is someone who has a paraphilia. The paraphilia gets a bit out of hand and takes a life over. And I think that there is merit in that description, as the autogynephilic behavior, the autogynephile's behavior, causes an enormous amount of destruction to their relationships, the people around them. Again, this is something that has utterly failed to go acknowledged. And when I came onto the internet and started talking about this about 6 or 7 years ago, saying, you know, you're out there, you're celebrating this, and no one, you're not acknowledging that you have that there are a vast number of children and female partners and also male partners of these men who are doing this, who have essentially become the collateral damage for these men to go out and live their lives. But like you say, that the whole thing is a lot more nuanced than it's simply being a fetish. And it is, you know, it is the evolution within these men of this idea of themselves as a woman, in this long-term, deeply emotional relationship. I mean, you've read Becoming What They Love. I mean, the way that Anne Lawrence discusses it, it's like this, you know, as the teenage boy has these fantasies, and it becomes a very intense erotic behavior that over time, you know, just like a heterosexual relationship, it will peter out. And it will, you know, it will come back years later, but it, and then it will enter some sort of comfortable middle age with with little or no sexual involvement. It's almost like a pattern of a heterosexual relationship. See, the whole subject is absolutely fascinating.
It is.
But to and the way you see it there, you can see exactly how it is that this, you know, the predictions that Blanchard makes, the contextualization that Anne Lawrence gives it is, it's amazing. It's so precise, you know, considering this is a, this is some sort of analysis of behavior, some sort of anthropology. It's very scientific in the way that it allows you to examine the behaviors, and it's quite amazing that the predictions that, you know, the predictions that it makes that turn out that you know that turn out, and you can say, well, you know, that's exactly what I would have expected. And I think, you know, one of the issues behind it is, of course, that what the trans community have done is they've gone out of the way to make, they're going out of the way at the moment to make reality of biological sex unutterable. But they've gone out of their way to prevent people from talking about the reality of what it is for most transsexuals to be transsexual. And by extension, I'd say what we're seeing as transgender is essentially the public acceptable face that we are dealing with a destigmatization. Well, it's not even a destigmatization. It is a cultural, growing cultural acceptance of transvesticism that we're seeing. But the way that it's being accommodated in society is that we are not looking at the reality of the situation and saying that these are men who cross-dress because at some point they would have had some sort of erotic interest in it. And these, you know, what we're seeing now with a lot of these younger people that we see who emerge on the internet, who are obsessed with anime and obsessed with anime porn, and they, you know, they've got their implausibly short skirt and their you know, their very revealing outfits on and whatnot, and it's a very sexually aggressive movement. And what we're being told is not that this is, you know, we're not taking the context of the permissive society to its logical conclusion and saying this is a fetish, you know, if people are going to indulge in this, then let them indulge in it in their own homes, as long as it causes them no harm or whatever like that. What's actually happening here is that we're being told that this behavior is actually making these men women, and that by the corollary of that is that being a woman is someone who is, you know, is that prop that exists in society for sexual excitement and sexual gratification. It's dehumanizing, and what we're actually getting out there is a group of men who are confusing what it is to feel sexy with feeling like a woman, because to them, being a woman is all about feeling sexy. Wow. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. and more so, I so many different directions we can go. It does seem, you know, that regressive or illiberal is how some classical liberals would describe some of the ideas. And it does kind of come up in this conversation when it seems like these misogynistic stereotypes of what it means to be female are being resurrected, dusted off, and propped up by some of the underlying ideological commitments in, again, among some, for lack of better terms, trans activists, or even people who would be maybe even fit the who would act on an autogynephiliac type of desire. And I'm thinking of friends who they would say, you know, they struggle with this. This is something that they see, they wrestle with it. And I very much empathize with their struggle and long conversations. And, you know, a few that I'm thinking of are married, you know, and they're trying to be faithful to their wife. And there's just struggle. And they have a faith commitment too. So that adds a whole nother morality and a faith context where there's heightened shame and so on and so forth. So I have a lot of empathy when I talk about autogynephilia, but then when I see people try to ignore it, I that's when I'm like, well, that's not, that doesn't, to pretend like it doesn't exist doesn't actually help people work through this. And even in reading Lawrence's work, it's like so many people, testimonies saying, thank you for giving me space to talk about. Now I can understand myself better, you know, whether they're in a faith context or not, you know. So I think it's just unfortunate when a piece of the human experience is ignored for the sake of trying to sanitize maybe a greater movement. I do want to talk about trans children, and I'm concerned about your time. How are you doing on?
No, it's all good. I'll just respond to what you're saying.
Yeah.
There. I think that the trans movement, I don't think it's making very many friends. And I think that there will be, we're seeing quite a lot of pushback in this country. I think the pushback is going to negatively affect trans people. I think that some of the pushback is definitely impacting upon particularly gay men. I think by extension it's likely to affect lesbianism and lesbians groups as well, but to me at the moment the main pushback seems to be affecting gay men's culture. I think the main problem with the with what trans people are telling people that they have to accept is that it's not based upon reality, and I don't think that that is something that the public is going to buy, and I don't think it's sustainable. And I think that fundamentally the way that the trans rights movement, if that's what we want to call it, I think fundamentally the way that these ideas are being pushed, it's coercive. It has to be coercive because it is not something that is based upon reality. For example, if we, a comparison that is made, you see many people will say, well, trans women are just like any other type of women, like, black women or disabled women. Well, black women are still women. You know, they are the, you know, they are black human beings who have reproductive systems, female reproductive systems, and are responsible for birthing 100% of the population, and if we look at the language that's being used around it, they've tried very hard to co-opt the language and the tactics of the black civil rights movement. But if you look at the black civil rights movement, even the gay liberation movement, the black civil rights movement, the idea was that black people should have the same rights, the same equality of opportunity as white people should. Mm. Not that black people should be called white. Mm-hmm. Or that gay people said, well, we want the same opportunities that heterosexuals have. But the gay community did not say, but we want to be called heterosexual.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. And I, there's certain differences in reality in some of these different civil rights movements. For instance, the civil rights movements in the 50s and 60s, and then even the movement towards marriage equality. To be attracted to the same sex, to be gay, is to be gay. Like there's nothing in reality that's untrue there. But once I'm kind of like asking for feedback here. Once a male says, I want to be recognized as a female, on one hand, socially, just from a political perspective, it's kind of like, well, it's a free country. You can say whatever you want, but, to demand that people sign off on the same reality claim, that is a question. I'm trying to be neutral here. That is a questionable reality claim. Whereas if a gay man says, I'm attracted to men, that's not a questionable, that's just a true statement. But those they're very different kind.
This brings a whole load of problems to the yard. The kickback against trans activism in the gay community and the lesbian community is quite well documented. I've written about this idea of the cotton ceiling. You probably read my my piece, which was like probably the best title I've ever come up with in my entire life.
Yes,
Girl Dick, the cotton ceiling and the cultural war on lesbians and women. And it was like I was asked to do this piece by Arthur Ellen 2 years ago, and 2 or 3 years ago. I got the call, and I had a 20-minute journey home. And between having the call to do it and getting home, I knew exactly what I wanted to say. Sat down at my desk for 20 minutes, and that was it, 3,000 words, bang. I knew exactly what I wanted to say and how to say it. And I've been involved in this damn thing for so long that it was so super easy for me to remember. You know, I knew who all the culprits were. I, you know, if I needed to think of, right, you know, need a man pretending to be a woman going into a LGBT group and telling women that they, telling lesbians that they should suck dick because it's on a woman. Aha, that's Morgan Page. Or I need to know a porn star who is shaming a female lesbian, lesbians are female, a lesbian porn star for not wanting to be, not wanting to cast him opposite her. I can go to Chelsea Poe and the very robust and very compassionate fight back that the porn, lesbian porn actor Lily Cade did against Poe's rather rapey attempts to get himself cast in a lesbian porn movie. And it was just such an easy thing to write. But I think, you know, I think the problem is that if you look at the trans rights movement, what that they are doing, they're not asking people of anything. They are telling people, and they are telling people the threat of cancellation, of economic loss, of contacting their friends, of ostracizing them, even physical violence. We've seen physical violence in this country. We've seen threats there. We've seen rape threats and death threats. You know, I've done talks in places, and where the organizers have had people shut down the venues. The people have turned up to protest outside. They've threatened people. In one event, they started a fight, and a woman was beaten. It's beaten by a man. That was Maria McLachlan was beaten by a man. You know, it's like, given this situation, which you'd ordinarily think that it's reached such a terrible state of affairs where a woman gets beaten up in Hyde Park. To me, the natural response to that would be, let's get everyone together around the table and say, right, it's gone too far. We must work together on this. Let this never, ever, ever happen again. But what happened? LGBT organizations doubled down. The response by Stonewall was absolutely pathetic. It was too little too... Sorry, it's Kat. It was too little too late. And, you know, it talked about, you know, people should do this and people should do that. It's like, showed absolutely no community leadership. I thought it was Ruth Hunt's, the nadir of Ruth Hunt's utterly dire stewardship of Stonewall. What Ruth Hunt has done to Stonewall is just, it's just beyond the pale. But she's got her 13 pieces of silver in the House of Lords. There you go, biblical reference, you see.
You do go to church. I see it. All right. And you got the number, 30 pieces of silver. Good job. I'm still curious about how your own personal experience fits into this. My assumption, because I know a few other people who would be identify as transsexual, and when the way they would describe it is, look, I am always my sex. I have this thing that psychologists call gender dysphoria, and the best way to relieve this and to be happy was to transition. But I still don't deny my biological sex. This is just, you know, or even Blair White. I don't know if you know Blair White. You know, she's like, look, I'm biologically male. I'm not going to deny that. I just got, in her words, you know, screwed by nature. And she used a different phrase, but I mean, and it is what it is. I'm happy now, but to create a whole new kind of maybe ideology out of this, I think is what she would say is wrong-headed. Does that resonate with you? How would you describe your personal experience vis-a-vis some of the transgender claims, the larger trans ideological claims?
I don't really understand the question. I don't really know what you're asking there. What I would say is that I think I think the best way to live a life, the best way to get as much as you can out of a life, is to live authentically. I like being a fun kind of individual. I like being someone who enjoys some of the delicious darker music out there. I like to, you know, wear the black cardiac shirt, walk around looking like something from the 1980s, you know, as I often say, you know, dressed as a cake. But, you know, it's just fun. It doesn't change who I am. And I think living life authentically, is very important. I've seen, you know, I've peeked into conversations on Twitter before where I've seen trans people who've not been able to go to the door to pick up a pizza because they've not had mascara and high heels on. I don't think that's living an authentic life. That's just fucking ridiculous. Sorry.
Let me reword my question in a simple way. Like, why did you transition? Why do you identify as transsexual?
Oh gosh. I've unpacked so many of these things now. I think that most of the words that I would use to explain why I transitioned and why I went through what I went through, each would come with so many caveats.
Yeah, that's fine.
I wouldn't say that I bought into transgender ideology as it exists now. I certainly became obsessed with the idea that I was transsexual, and I went through everything that I could possibly do to achieve what transsexual meant to me, which is what transsexual used to mean. It would be someone that you would have a fair amount of counselling, and you would unpack your behaviour and your attitudes to life, and you get your mental health in order, and then you would transition, and then you would, you know, attempt to live this life and assimilate and just get on with things without being a dick, really. And that's what I did, and it was a way of eliminating a number of conflicts, and certainly a huge amount of alienation that I felt with myself and between myself and the outside world. Yeah. But you know, I'm not the same person as I was then. I think we all evolve and we grow as human beings, and I think with a lot of hindsight, it's, you know, my life has been informed by this journey that I've been on, and you know, I like to be honest with myself, and I do quite a lot of thinking, and I like to, you know, like I say, be authentic. And I would question so many of the reasons why I did what I did, and I think that a lot of trans people would. And I think that associated with trans, I think that what a lot of people who are transitioning are doing at the moment is they are going through some quite large changes in their life. Even this whole idea of adopting this social role of being someone who is the opposite sex, which of course doesn't really work, it's, they become a parody. That in itself is an absolutely huge deal, and it's very damaging. And a lot of people are going through these processes and making these decisions and causing a huge amount of difficulty for themselves and their loved ones, in particular their wives and their children. And they're doing this without ever achieving any understanding of why they feel about themselves the way that they do.
I'm sorry.
And I think that is tragic.
I'm fiddling around here. My computer, I just noticed, is about to die. So I need to... And this is...
That's okay.
And whatever I'm doing here is not working. So let me... give me...
Maybe you better stop praying.
Yeah, can you... Well, you're the churchgoer. You're the churchgoer. Maybe... well, there we are.
I did... In my first year at university, I studied philosophy as well as the main modules that I was doing. I did a philosophy course that was on politics and ethics, logic, metaphysics, philosophy of religion, and something else which escapes me, I'll remember. And it was amazing. I found the whole thing absolutely fascinating. I discovered the writing of Søren Kierkegaard, whose work I absolutely adore.
Interesting. I'm going to look over here now because I changed screens. I don't know if this worked or not. So if it deletes.
Yeah, I can see you.
Well, I mean, we've gone over an hour, so maybe we can wrap it up. We didn't get to trans kids.
There's no such thing as a trans kid. A trans kid is the equivalent of the vegan cat. It's not something that kids or cats do voluntarily.
So I'm going to get some emails. I'll direct them to you on that. You would acknowledge that there are children who are male or female who experience what psychologists now call gender dysphoria.
I would say define gender dysphoria.
Can you define?
And also, I would suggest that what the boys and these girls are feeling is very different to what we have historically, what may have historically been categorized as gender dysphoria. I mean, gender dysphoria is, to my mind, my own experience, is a combination of depression and obsessive behavior and a bunch of other anxieties as well. And it's something that the person needs to work through. It's not symptomatic that you've magically been born the wrong sex.
Right.
It's just that your sex becomes a matter of fixation.
So, I mean, so gender dysphoria, I'm going off the cuff here. I mean, some high level of distress somebody feels, experiences with regard to their biological sex. Now that etiology of it, the cause of it, the roots of it, you know, that's a different debate. but obviously some people do experience that distress. Now you're saying that could be, often is, maybe intertwined with several other mental health issues.
I've said a number of times that my belief is that what we call gender dysphoria is not itself a discrete condition, that gender dysphoria is a constellation of a number of different symptoms. And I think that what happens is that the individual becomes fixated upon this idea of changing their sex as being a way that they will be able to alleviate and come out the other side from the issues that they face.
If that's if that's true, then you would be very much for the idea of gender dysphoria being addressed through psychotherapy. I mean, psychological means, because that's precisely what the issue is, not rushing kids to physically transition. Deal with the mental health issues first, and that.
I agree. I totally agree. The mental health issues are seem to always be the Cinderella of any health service that you look at, and I think mental health care provision is inadequate in this country. I think it is in pretty much every single country, and I think that mental health care is absolutely necessary. I think that any therapy that people are having, any people who are claiming to be trans, that the therapy that they're having should not be about facilitating transition. It should be helping them to come to terms with who and what they are.
And would you still say somebody experiences early onset gender dysphoria? I've got friends from the time they were 3 years old, just so severe. And let's just say they do go through all the mental health, you know, means of addressing it, and they do take care of other issues or whatever, and say they turn into adults, you know, and they're still very severely gender dysphoric. Would you say in that case, transitioning might be the best way to finally relieve, as a last resort, maybe their dysphoria? Or
I think you're begging the question there, because I think that you're presupposing that if there is a, even if there is a adequate and well-researched protocol as to how we resolve these internal conflicts that people may have, then there will always be people that will still want to do it. And I'm not sure that that's the case. You know, I mentioned to you, excuse me, I mentioned to you before a piece that I've done on pornography and autogynephilia. If you have any wealthy listeners who would like to fund me doing a PhD, I would love to look at the influence of pornography on the outbreak of transgenderism that we see. And, you know, you look at the works of, you know, some fairly prominent writers like Julia Serrano or Sam Rydell or Andrea Chu, and the you know, within their writing, it's there. Sissy porn, Japanese cartoon porn. Mm-hmm. It's all about the pornography. And you know, I'm no prude, but I think pornography is dehumanizing. I think sexual relationships between consenting, loving human beings is all well and good, and you know, I think consenting, meaningless sex is, you know, is pretty much okay as well. You know, it's not abusive, but I think pornography is a pornography is abusive. It's very, very, you know, although it's become acceptable after the, you know, after this 70s sexual liberation and whatever, and it's not actually that countercultural. In fact, it's incredibly conservative. Pornography sells itself as being transgressive, but actually it's not transgressive. It's incredibly conservative. What it does, it's all about men dominating women, and it's all about exploiting men dominating women, and making money from men dominating women, and dehumanizing women and keeping women down. You know, even in gay pornography, you can see a power vector. With men's, you know, within the gay scene, you see that there is a lot of there's no real place for feminine gay men. It's such a shame that the feminine gay man is not given the support within the gay scene that I think that perhaps that gay man could be. And I think that, you know, that might have some bearing on what we see within the trans scene. But what concerns me a lot is the influence on pornography. And you only have to see the way that pornography affects the mannerisms, the clothes, and the, you know, even the names that a lot of these people are, you know, when you've got a 54-year-old 20 stone man who's transitioning and call himself things like Angel Crystal, it's like, you know, do me a favor, mate.
Oh, okay. Well, so yeah, that's a good place to, I think, cut it off. Our audience has a lot to think about, and we've only scratched the surface. My mind was just kind of spinning when you're connecting the dots between pornography and, I mean, lots of things going on in our culture today. I've talked to mental health counselors that say, you know, we deal with so many different unwanted sexual desires in the last 10 years, where in the past that was always linked to sexual trauma, some abusive situation. But now we're seeing people with no past of sexual trauma coming in with the same kinds of unwanted sexual behavior or desires, and they're linking it to pornography. And I think only time will tell the societal ramifications of widespread internet porn, which, as you said, or I'll say it resonates with what you're saying, almost always leads to violence towards women and children, which is profoundly regressive. Well, Miranda, thank you. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I mean, I don't know how many Christian podcasts you've been a guest on.
I did some videos with someone I know from America called Raya Jones, who is a pastor now, I believe. And we had a lot of fun talking about stuff. I'm going to leave you with some last words.
Yes, go for it.
The 1860s, John Stuart Mill, whose work I've mentioned before, he wrote an essay called "The Subjection of Women," which he finished with the assistance of Helen Taylor, who was the daughter of Harriet Taylor, who was his wife. Harriet had died in France, I think about 20 years previously, and "The Subjection of Women" was written based upon an essay by. Sorry, my cats are being antsy. An essay by Harriet Taylor called "The Enfranchisement of Women," and Mill delayed the publication of "The Subjection of Women" until he knew that he was dying, because the attitudes that he was expressing in there about the idea that the only thing that prevents women from being doctors and teachers and map readers is because society says that women can't be teachers and doctors and map readers. This idea ran so strongly against the ethos of the European court at that time. By the court, I mean, you know, society at that time, that, you know, he was concerned about the kickback, and he essentially released the essay only when he realized that he was dying, so he didn't really care what people thought. And it just, you know, there you go, a true political radical who even then recognized that the most transgressive thing that you can actually do is to stick up for women. And now those of us who are standing for women in this ground, those of the women and the men and the trans people who stand this ground for women and say that this movement is toxic and it's damaging and what it's doing is wrong, that we are the ones who are truly transgressive. And it is the socially conservative people, the socially conservative groups, the trans groups, who are so rigidly defined in what their own identity allows them to be, that are fighting against those of us who yet again say that the most radical thing that you can do as a man is to respect women.
Wow. We should close in prayer, Miranda. thank you so much. You've given us a lot to think about, and this is going to be, I didn't tell you this, but I'm actually having a whole spectrum of different trans voices on the show for a kind of a series of conversations. And thank you so much for playing if I can say, a very unique role in this broader conversation.
Thank you. I hope I brought some light to the conversation. That's the most important thing to me.
That's great. Light and darkness. Another spiritual metaphor.
Very well.
All right.
More light, less heat.
Take care, Miranda.